Welcome to the 2024 Volume 5, Issue 2, Winter Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published February 28, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 1. Table of Contents. Cochrane, Tom. 2024. Precy. The Emotional Mind. A Control Theory of Affective States. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, Number 2. 1-16. https://doi.org/10.33497/2024-winter.1. Hatzimoisis, Anthony. 2024. Valent Representation. Problems and Prospects. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, Number 2. 17-23. https://doi.org/10.33497/2024-winter.2. Kufendieck, Rebecca and Christine Sievers. 2024. Valent Representations, Bodily Feelings and Social Norms. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, Number 2. 24-29. https://doi.org/10.33497/2024-winter.3. Majid Rami. 2024. Cochrane's Nativism. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 5, Number 2. 30-35. https://doi.org/10.33497/2024-winter.4.
Article 1. The Emotional Mind, A Control Theory of Affective States. By Tom Cochrane. The Emotional Mind, A Control Theory of Affective States. Cochrane, 2018. Grew out of an attempt to give an original account of the emotions. As anyone who has researched this area can tell you, the more you explore the emotions, the more you realize how complex they are. They connect to all sorts of issues about bodily sensations, actions, values, reasoning, character, and social interactions. Ultimately, I don't think a proper account of the emotions is possible without understanding how they are placed within the mind as a whole. This is what I try to provide in the book. As a result, I end up with a theory of mental architecture, where the mind is structured around fundamental life-sustaining processes that deploy ever more elaborate forms of representation to serve their aims. First, some brief background. The theory of emotion, since at least William James' classic paper, 1884, has been dominated by a debate between the traditional cognitivist position that emotions are a species of evaluative judgment and the non-cognitive or somaticist position that emotions are patterns of bodily sensations. As far as I can tell, everyone these days is searching for the ideal middle ground where evaluative judgment and bodily responses are perfectly synthesized. It is not enough to say that emotions combine bodily responses and judgment. The key adaptive innovation of emotions will lie in how exactly these two features are connected. In recent times, the perceptual theory of emotions has presented a particularly strong synthesis. As Prinz, 2004, articulates it, the feelings of bodily changes themselves represent the intentional contents of emotions. However, there have been a number of attacks on this theory, and in my opinion, the perceptual theory cannot recover. Michael Brady, 2013, has a book-length attack on the epistemic analogy with perception, pointing out that emotions do not automatically justify belief in the way that perceptions do. It is also clear that emotions are routinely mediated by other perceptual or mental states, like imagining, memory, and the interoception of bodily responses, in a way that just doesn't fit the profile of perception. The reader may further refer to Salmela, 2011, Diana and Terroni, 2012, CH6, Barlasina and Nguyen, 2013, and Munn, 2021, for further attacks, plus a few in my own book. A new kind of emotion theory has drawn more deeply on the connection between emotions and action. It tries to move beyond perceptual theory by arguing that bodily responses should be understood less as the representational content of an emotional state, and more like its mode or attitude, e.g., refer to Diana and Terroni, 2012, also Hufendieck, 2016, to some extent. That is, we don't represent danger or loss or gain, We represent in a threatened, protective, or welcoming mode by responding in the ways characteristic of fear, sadness, or happiness, respectively. I did not go quite as far as Diana and Tironi, since I still believe that emotions represent a particular kind of content. However, I similarly regard the evaluative aspect of emotions not as something that we represent, but as captured in an evaluative manner of representing. That is, I claim that it is part of the representational activity of emotional states that responses are triggered to either increase or decrease the presence of their objects. Section 1. Valent representation. This approach to the emotions needs to be motivated. While it is convenient to say that emotions are evaluative modes of representation, we need a stronger reason to believe in this sort of mental state other than the fact that it conveniently combines a bodily and cognitive aspect of emotion. The way I provide this motivation is by digging into the problem of mental content. The basic problem of mental content is how some activity inside the head could be about a specific kind of object in the world. Structural resemblances may well be involved, but resemblance is too cheap to fix objects precisely. Thus, a lot of philosophers have thought that some kind of pragmatic interaction with the object could fix things precisely. Teleosemantic views are one approach, e.g. Millikan 1989, Dretzky 1995, and have been applied to emotion by Prinz 2004 and Price 2015. Success semantics is another approach, originally devised by Ramsey 1927-1990, referred in an aid 2013 for a recent discussion. Success semantics is roughly the claim that a mental state represents whatever object makes actions based on that state successful. So, for example, your mental state is about the chair. If, on the basis of your mental state, you are able to successfully interact with the chair. In this sense, interaction with the world is necessary for fixing the reference of the mental state. A problem for success semantics is that it seems that you need both beliefs slash percepts about the world and desires about one's goals to be in place before any mental state can have any content at all. That is, to guide an action like sitting down, I need to both perceive the chair and desire to sit down in it. To require both percepts and desires to appear simultaneously is implausibly complex as an account to how mental content naturalistically emerges. To get around this problem, we need mental states that serve the duty of percepts and desires simultaneously. To achieve this, I propose a new fundamental sort of mental state, which I call valent representation. Valent representations use negative feedback loops, as depicted in Figure 1. In this loop, as the level of heat gets higher, the activity of the detection node will get higher. This then increases the activity of moving backwards. But if the creature moves backwards, the level of heat for the organism will get lower, and so activity in the detection node will fall, eventually leading to inactivity until the level of heat rises again. Thus, the presence of heat for the organism is regulated. I call this an avoidant loop. The great thing about control loops like this is that we don't need separate descriptive and directive representations. One representational node, the detection stage in the diagram above, is doing the work of both functions. That is, the node serves a descriptive belief-like function by tracking the presence of certain states of affairs. Simultaneously, it serves a directive desire-like function by directing the organism to bring about certain states of affairs. We can also have attractant loops where at the level of a good thing like food falls low enough, activity in the detector or hunger, node increases, triggering a response that will secure food, ultimately leading to the inhibition of the feeding response. Refer to Figure 2. Now, because negative feedback loops are common in nature, there's an issue about how we distinguish the representational ones from the non-representational ones. And I spent a lot of time in chapter 1 of my book justifying various details, including what makes a creature alive. However, I will skip here to the final definition of valent representation. X valently represents Y IFF. X is a living creature. Y is a type of object or property, the object. An indicator of Y either activates or inhibits activity in a system internal to X, the detector. The activity of the detector triggers a physically distinct and specific response, the response. The response is capable of decreasing the present capacity of Y to activate the response via the detector, negative feedback regulation. Essentially, valent representation is representation in a valent, i.e., positive or negative, manner. What makes it valent is that the representational activity automatically triggers a bodily response aimed at increasing or decreasing the presence of the object. The theory is still representationalist in the sense that there is an inner state or activity that stands in for the object, i.e., the detection node. But at the same time, it strongly incorporates embodied views on cognition, since the response is playing an indispensable role in the activity of representation. The object of the mental state, e.g., presence of food, is all and only those conditions that the response can regulate. Finally, an important feature of valent representation is that we can build all sorts of elaborations upon the basic loop structure. For instance, we can make the detection nodes trigger a response only once a certain threshold of activity is reached, or detection can trigger multiple responses, or responses can trigger further responses. Valent representations can also interact with each other, inhibiting and supporting each other. This is how I make sense of the representation of more complex objects. Affective states like pain, pleasure, and emotion require more elaborate structures. But I argue that, in the end, they all come down to the same fundamental structure of negative feedback control. Indeed, I think that all cognition is ultimately an elaboration upon valent representation. Overall, valent representation elegantly combines the three aspects of the mind: representation, agency, and evaluation. It is a major claim of the book that these three strands start out as merged in the primitive mind, and it is only through various cognitive sophistications that they get teased apart. Section 2. Pain and Pleasure. Upon the foundation stone of valent representation, the rest of the mind is built. Each chapter of my book explains a type of valent representation that is incrementally more complex and sophisticated than the one considered in the previous chapter. My first stop is pain and pleasure. An important thing to note straight away is that although valent representation is representation in a valent, i.e., positive or negative manner, it is not a representation of valence. That is, the content of a basic valent representation is not "this is bad" or "this is good." Indeed, one of the reasons that pain has become such a hot topic lately is due to the recognition that the intrinsically unpleasant aspects of pain are distinct from the representation of damage to the body, which should already be tracked by the most basic sort of valent representation. A significant justification for this distinction is the existence of pain asymbolia, which is a condition in which individuals are able to identify a sensation as a pain and yet not experience this feeling as bad. The very possibility of this condition forces the distinction upon us. Thus, philosophers have been trying to give accounts of what exactly makes an experience intrinsically unpleasant. In addition, some philosophers propose symmetrical accounts for the intrinsically pleasurable aspects of experience, e.g., Barlasina and Hayward 2019. This is justified because while we observe opposed responses or attitudes between experiences that are intrinsically painful and experiences that are intrinsically pleasant, there is also a great deal that they have in common. Following Murad Edidi, 2014, I use the term effect to cover both pleasant and unpleasant aspect of experience. We can then define an affective state as any mental state that involves the arousal of affect. I encourage others to adopt this terminology. An initial point to make about affect is that it must have some important connection with responding towards things in a valent way. Painful and pleasurable affect must involve approach and avoidance responses respectively, even if we're just talking about a cognitive kind of response like making plans or recalling details. If they did not, we would have no way to distinguish affect from non-affective sensations, and no way to oppose pain with pleasure. This is not to deny the existence of cases where we might embrace a pain or avoid a pleasure, but those should be understood as complex and derivative cases. It is also not a claim that valent treatment is sufficient for affect. For instance, motivational states like curiosity can get us to increase the availability of certain things, without the motivational impulse feeling either intrinsically pleasant or intrinsically unpleasant. Instead, valent treatment is in some way necessary for affect. However, this allows for two options: one where affect is involved in directing the valent treatment, and another where affect is involved in tracking the valent treatment. These options correspond to two broad approaches to affect: evaluativism, where affect describes a condition of the body, e.g., Bain 2013, and imperativism, where affect directs the subject to do something, e.g., Klein 2007. My approach is basically evaluativist. There are various reasons for this. One major reason is that motivational responses towards good and bad conditions already occur without the stimulation of effect. Instead, the most distinctive motivational output of effect is to prioritize or boost those pre-existing responses by grabbing our attention. Yet grabbing attention is something that pain and pleasure have in common. Since the key output response of effect does not distinguish pain and pleasure, directing such an output response cannot explain what makes pain intrinsically painful or pleasure intrinsically pleasant. Another major reason for the evaluativist approach is that imperativism does not do well with pleasant effect. This is because a mental state in which one strongly or urgently directs a subject to acquire a certain good is compatible with lacking the good or the experience of the good entirely. And such states of yearning are typically quite unpleasant. What we also need for pleasant effect is for such a motivation to coexist with actually having some of a good thing. Thus, I argue that pleasurable effect is essentially a representation of success, that the organism is directed towards acquiring some good and has managed to do so. I call this a success theory of pleasure. I then offer a symmetrical failure theory of pain, where the subject is directed toward avoiding some harm, and yet the harm is still present. The causal schemata for these states is illustrated in Figure 3. The upshot is that effect is a higher-level representation that combines a representation of harm or benefit with a representation of the directive response. Thus, the model is that on top of regular valent representations, there's a higher-level node that monitors the presence of a good and one's response. Meanwhile, effect itself follows the structure of a negative feedback loop because, as mentioned above, also automatically triggers a response of increased attention. Thus, my model is that organisms already need to automatically respond to harms and benefits prior to developing the capacities for pain or pleasure. Yet, pleasurable and painful effect reinforce these responses and thus serve the underlying regulative function. A final significant aspect of the account is the following hypothesized equation for effect intensity. Effect equals response x object presence. That is, the intensity of pleasurable or painful effect is equal to the detected intensity of the response multiplied by the detected degree to which the harm or benefit is present. This means that if either the object or the response level is detected as zero, the subject should experience no effect at all. I think this equation could be a significant psychological principle, particularly given the role of effect in directing attention. So, I am hopeful that it will be empirically confirmed. Section 3. Emotions. We have now reached a level of complexity in the mind in which we can have emotional states. As mentioned in the introduction, like Diana and Tarroni, I incorporate the evaluative aspect of emotions into the manner or mode of approaching the object rather than its representational content. Where my theory differs from that of Diana and Tarroni's is that I still attribute a constitutive role to cognitive representation in helping us to grasp the object of the emotion and to trigger the appropriate responses. That is, if we consider the detection box in all the above negative feedback loop diagrams, we need to make this box a bit more complex to make sense of what's going on in emotions. An innovation of mine is to describe the characteristic form that these representations take. I claim that emotions valiantly represent a contrast between the current state of affairs and some other state, not in the here and now. For example, fear involves a representation of an upcoming harm, a temporal contrast. Jealousy involves a representation of someone else getting a good thing, a social contrast. And regret involves a representation of a bad thing that might not have happened, a modal contrast. Even surprise involves a contrast between expectations and reality, a basic kind of modal contrast. I call these situated concerns to distinguish them from the way that pains and pleasures track immediate harms and benefits. It is plausible that many non-human animals can represent at least some of these contrasts, i.e., by means of memory or imagination, and thus we can allow for emotions in non-human animals. Note in particular that such contrasts are a way to use structural features of cognition, e.g., the contrast between a percept and memory, to capture content and thus eliminate the need for symbolic concepts. It is important to note that the representation of contrast makes emotions more sophisticated than pains and pleasures because the subject is now oriented towards the wider context. This means that the subject can now serve his or her interests in a more contextually sensitive way, thus making sense of the appearance of the emotional capacity from a selective point of view. Overall, my slogan definition is that emotions are valent representations of situated concerns. This definition offers a minimal requirement for all emotional states. Above, I provide a schematic illustration for the emotion of fear, refer to Figure 4. So, in this case, there is an underlying aversive negative feedback loop on the left-hand side. On top of this loop is built an additional node that detects when the presence of the harmful object is increasing. When this secondary node is activated, it triggers an avoidant response, e.g., to avoid an area where harms may be likely. In particular, this contextually sensitive response may be triggered prior to the avoidant response that will be triggered by the direct presence of the harm. This is because the increased node can be triggered by a relatively low level of presence, whereas a direct avoidant response will require a stronger degree of presence. For example, suppose that the creature is sensitive to various signs associated with the presence of harm, such as a certain smell. This smell is not yet strong enough to stimulate direct avoidance, but the mere fact of detecting an increasing presence is sufficient to motivate preemptive avoidance. Altogether, we can minimally characterize each emotion in terms of three factors. Whether the underlying valent representation is positive or negative. 2. The nature of the contrast structure involved, temporal, modal, or social. And 3. The specific kind of response triggered, e.g., running away versus retching, which helps to specify the type of object. Section 4. Coping potential. A crucial difference between my theory and somaticist theories, such as Diana and Terroni 2012, Hufendieck 2016, is that while I think bodily responses play a necessary role in emotions, I do not think the feelings of those changes are necessary for emotions. In particular, it is possible to have an emotion where one is unconscious of one's bodily changes. However, I think bodily feelings play a supplementary role in capturing a distinct, though complementary, sort of intentional content which I call emotional bodily feeling, also referred in my 2017 paper, which is an earlier version of Chapter 4 of my book. While emotional bodily feelings are not necessary for emotions in general, they are necessary for some emotions because they add an additional layer of control. The sophistication here is that by tracking one's automatically triggered bodily responses and anticipating how well this bodily response can manage one's situation, one can then stimulate further responses that modulate or inhibit one's initial reaction. This is analogous to what psychologists like Klaus Scherrer, 2005, call coping potential. In order to grasp the important role that this extra control level has, let's analyze the emotion of sadness. On my view, sadness requires at least three control layers. First layer, we have an underlying concern. This can be either a positively valent attraction to something, e.g. your beloved, or a negatively valent aversion to something, e.g. being hit. Basic attractions and aversions do not require contrast representations. When the level of the attractant is low, a response is simply triggered to increase the level. Second layer, we represent the attractant as lost, this is a temporal contrast, or an avoidant as gained. This representation automatically triggers a response to reduce the presence of the loss, so it's a negatively valent representation in that sense, by restoring the presence of the lost thing. Third layer, so far, this response is common to both anger and sadness, so we need a third layer to differentiate anger from sadness. The third layer is where the initial bodily response is represented, but then appraised as inadequate to restore the loss. This leads to a secondary response to inhibit the first set of responses and to engage compensatory responses instead. That is, sadness is overall the valent representation of being unable to restore a loss. Meanwhile, anger is where you do feel powerful enough to meet the challenge, and you gear yourself precisely to do this, to get back the lost thing, or to remove the barriers to getting it. However, anger can burn itself out if, by trying, you find you can do absolutely nothing about it, in which case I would expect a response to switch to sadness. I would also allow the following qualification to the above causal model for sadness. It seems possible that instead of fully triggering the initial restoration response, we simply prepare this response at a neural level. This may be sufficient to generate a bodily feeling, in line with what Antonio Damasio, 2000, calls the as-if loop of bodily feeling. It should also be sufficient to enable the individual's coping potential to be calculated, and the response accordingly modulated prior to triggering useless restoration responses. However, I still claim that it is typical of sadness that an initial restorative response is triggered. For example, in the film Brokeback Mountain, there's a very moving scene at the end where Ennis embraces the shirt of his dead lover, Jack. Ennis wants Jack, so he grasps at this token, but he's also keenly aware that he cannot get Jack back, and that is a core of his desperate sadness, a secondary. But I think significant consequence of this theory of coping potential is that it allows for an additional form of value on top of the experience of pleasure. Basically, when one anticipates or judges that one's responses are sufficient to deal with potential demands, one feels confident or powerful. Achieving this feeling can be an important source of motivation. Section 5. Social emotions. So far we have 4 control levels. Valent representation, effect, contrast representations, and coping potential. To make sense of the social emotions, we need even more. Often, when we think of social emotions, we are thinking of particular emotions like jealousy, contempt, or gratitude. However, we should regard social emotionality as an additional layer of regulation that sits on top of regular emotional states. On this view, most human emotions have a social aspect. To explain this, I once again appeal to control theory. I claim that social emotions are a valent representation aimed at regulating a relationship. In particular, social emotions involve the regulation of what I call a group's affiliative status. The affiliative status between 2 or more people is defined as a combination of their power relationship and their intimacy relationship. Our intimacy relationship is fixed by the range of things we're disposed to cooperate on, e.g., from bodily pleasures to paying the bills. Our power relationship characterizes what we can expect from each other in terms of support. I might serve you more than you serve me. Thus, I may have a relatively intimate and equal relationship with my wife, while I have a relatively distant and power-imbalanced relationship with my boss. A group's affiliative status can change over time, but crucially, members form expectations about how other members are supposed to act in conformity with it. This includes both the way we treat each other and the attitudes we might expect ourselves to share towards events in the shared environment, e.g., finding the same things amusing, disgusting, or annoying. Thus, if my wife behaves in a way contrary to this expectation, I will respond emotionally in a way aimed at restoring the expected relationship. My wife may equally think that my behavior fails to cohere with our affiliative status. Thus, she may respond emotionally in kind. In this way, a social-emotional negotiation will take place, and hopefully we will eventually end up on the same page, emotionally speaking. If not, this will probably lead to a change in our affiliative relationship. The principal mechanism by which social emotions function is via expressions in the face, voice, and posture. I largely follow Mitchell Green, 2007, in thinking that expressions signal to each other our emotional states for the sake of social negotiation. CF Behavior Ecology Views. I supplement this with my analysis of emotional bodily feelings, that is, the experience we have of the bodily changes triggered in emotional states. Both when I trigger the various bodily changes associated with anger, and when I observe someone else doing the same thing, the same mechanism is involved in taking that pattern of responses to represent the capability and disposition of the agent to act in a certain way. For anger, in particular, a reciprocal pattern of expressions allows agents to compare their relative preparedness to attack and negotiate and establish their affiliative status without resorting to physical violence. A crucial part of my account is that an affiliative status does not belong to the individual. No individual can unilaterally establish a settled relationship with anyone else. It has to be agreed by all parties involved. As a result, I argue that the regulated process must be understood as a collective phenomenon. I resist calling the social level of regulation a collective emotion, contra Margaret Gilbert, 2000. I think we can do everything we need with the notion of social norms. These norms only exist at the social level, and thus there is something irreducibly collective going on. But we need not suppose the existence of group minds or group mental states. These social norms can moreover spread through a population, allowing for the development of cultural emotional patterns. In retrospect, I should have made more explicit connections in my book to the reactive attitude tradition in ethics, i.e., the idea we get from Peter Strauss in that moral relationships are often a matter of feeling and expressing certain emotional states. I talk about social emotionality in larger groups in the book, but I only briefly mention the moral community. Note in particular that when the group is larger than a dyad, you can have an emotion aimed at regulating the affiliative status of the group where one group member has harmed another group member, though you are not affected. In this way, my model of social emotions can apply to resentment or sympathy we might feel for persons we have little contact with, but who are still members of our moral community. Section 6. Reason and emotion. Reason and emotion are often supposed to be at odds with each other. From one perspective, our emotions are like unruly toddlers, demanding and whimsical, that need to be held in check by the adult intellect. From another perspective, the rational mind is cold and calculating and needs the warmth of the passions to grasp what really matters. I don't think that either of these perspectives, properly understood, is wrong. Where they are potentially confusing is if they suggest that emotions and reason are two separate sources of agency vying for supremacy. For instance, Plato encourages this confusion with his tripartite model of the soul, e.g., in the Republic, Cooper and Hutchinson, eds. 1997. Kant does the same in the Critique of Practical Judgment, 1788, 2002, Book 1, Chapter 3, when he supposes that the rational grasp of moral imperatives can motivate action independently, and even in rejection of our passionate impulses. In contrast to Plato and Kant, we must remember that humans and other animals are single agents, and we have not evolved the resources of emotion and reason to fight against each other, but to ever more effectively protect the things we care about. Given this consideration, I think the correct thing to say is that reason elaborates emotion. That is, it's yet another layer of control. Most philosophers and psychologists of emotion agree that emotions have a descriptive function alongside their motivational function. Emotions inform us about the state of the world, that it is dangerous, enviable, disgusting, and so on. Naturally, the kinds of properties we are describing rely on the person care about certain things. They are relative to the individual in this sense. But given that the person cares about certain things, e.g., the integrity of his body, the status of his loved ones, it can be entirely factual that a situation threatens or supports him. Now along comes a capacity for rational inference. This allows emotions to massively expand their capacity to track the things the individual cares about, to check whether the initial emotional representation is accurate, to infer consequences, and have further emotions towards those consequences. This, I contend, is the main purpose of reason. At the same time, it is misleading to say that reason is slave to the passions, as David Hume, 1739-1978, famously declares in A Treatise of Human Nature. I claim that the motivational juice driving all cognition is drawn from our underlying homeostatic regulation systems. Emotions are one cognitive resource for elaborating these systems, while rational inferences are a further resource. This means that one concerned regulating system can overrule another, where the first is rationally elaborated and the second is not. The resulting experience can be one where we rationally infer that acting impulsively, say to run away from giving an important speech, could destroy one's reputation, and we accordingly stop ourselves. Thus, there is room for motivational conflict, but nothing so simple as reason controlling emotion. We could as easily say that one emotion is controlling another emotion here, or that one kind of thinking is controlling another kind of thinking. Section 7. Character. One final layer of control is required before we have a reasonably complete picture of our emotional lives. This is character. I analyze character as a combination of an individual's sentiments. Sentiments are basically long-term attitudes that we bear towards specific individuals, institutions, or causes, that is, the things that we love or hate. The important difference that such sentiments make is in getting an individual to prioritize the regulation of certain concerns over others in ways that can allow other emotional processes to be overruled. For example, when I love my children, I prioritize their flourishing over most other concerns. For instance, I may act to protect them even when it compromises my own safety. So, the fear for my safety can be overruled by the concern for my children. The most distinctive cognitive feature of sentiments is that they require us to track unique individuals, not just general types of aversive or attractive situations. Tracking unique individuals is, I argue, our most sophisticated representational activity. In particular, it necessitates that we generate a narrative history about the individual. These narrative histories pick out individuals so uniquely that they could not be replaced by another individual with the same set of qualities. The replacements lack the same history. Once we understand a way that love uniquely tracks individuals, we can make sense of long-term affective phenomena like grief. Peter Goldie, 2012, uses the example of grief to defend his narrative model of emotions because he thinks there is no essential emotional response or representation. Instead, we have different stages of grief that we link together. However, I argue that we can treat grief as a control process in fundamentally the same manner as other emotions. The key complication of grief over sadness is that the underlying concern attaches to a unique individual. Because the attachment is to a unique individual, this makes it impossible for the usual response to either restore or compensate the loss. Thus, a slow process is required where the control system has to gradually learn to no longer seek the presence of the loved one. The changes in strategy will correspond to the different stages of grief. Finally, note that character is not the same as personality. I provide a characterization of personality in the book in terms of general strategies that individuals develop to regulate their concerns. These strategies standardly combine the sensitivity to a certain concern, e.g., one's social relationships, with capacities, e.g., one's capacity to empathize with others. Like character, personality serves to individuate people since some people are more sensitive and more capable of regulating certain values than others. Moreover, personality traits are typically stable over the long term. However, personality operates at all levels of regulation, so it is not a distinct layer of control in the same way as character. Section 8, A Control Theory of the Mind. The final chapter of my book is on mental architecture. This is where I propose a control theory of the mind as a whole. It is perhaps the most ambitious and speculative chapter of a book that is probably already too ambitious for its own good. I am trying to fit together all the various mental processes that I have analyzed up to that point, homeostatic processes, pains and pleasures, emotions, bodily feelings, social emotions, emotion-driven thinking, and character traits. At the foundations of the mental architecture I propose lie the valent representations, basic negative feedback, control mechanisms that track simple properties and automatically trigger regulative responses. As we evolve more sophisticated ways to represent information, new types of affective state emerge. The basic idea is that new kinds of state elaborate the fundamental control structure, each new level building incrementally upon the last. Thus, representational sophistications develop for the sake of guiding our regulated processes more effectively. The more purely descriptive cognitive and perceptual functions are byproducts of these developments. In more detail, I outline the specific levels in the development of mental architecture, corresponding to the different affective states I analyze over the course of the book. Here is where the theory is most tentative, but it follows a general logic of how complexity develops step by step. That is, we need cognition of a certain complexity to be in place before cognition of a slightly greater complexity can plausibly emerge. Key to the development of cognitive complexity, in my view, is the interaction and competition between multiple valent representations. First, they inhibit each other. That is, the triggering of one valent representation prevents another valent representation from launching a conflicting response. Then valent representations start to associatively support each other, probably because some properties or the responses they trigger are more mutually compatible than others. Mutually supporting systems are motivated by the need to overcome the inhibitions of competing systems. The next step in complexity is the formation of higher-level representations. Higher-level representations infer structures or objects behind first-order appearances, CF connectionist approaches. They go beyond the mere bundles of properties that association captures. I claim that the model of effect I outlined, in which failure and success of regulation is represented, is the first higher-order representation. It is higher-order because it represents objects and the individual's own responses as bearing a relationship with each other. This is not a simple appearance. As mentioned above, affect also plays a special role in assigning attention, thus again serving the competition between valent representational systems. Emotions then involve a further sophistication, since they involve not just a representation of states of affairs, but a comparison between the current state of affairs and some other state, e.g. in the past or future. Emotional bodily feelings and our awareness of the emotions of others via their expressive behavior are the next step, involving a simulation of how an agent may behave in the future. This allows new kinds of calculations to be performed where the individual contrasts their emotional state with the emotions of others or represents them as coordinated in some respect, as in social-emotional regulation. The next steps involve the development of symbolic reference and inference rules. This is, of course, a major development of mind, and even in the book, I can only roughly sketch how it fits into the architecture. A basic idea is that once we have social-emotional norms, we are coordinating our references to the world, and we thereby have the beginnings of shared symbolic references to the world. For example, the shared expression of disgust comes to symbolically reference the disgusting object. However, when it comes to mental architecture, I think a whole new series of developments in representational sophistication build upon the basic foundation of symbolic thinking. I entertain the possibility that the developments in complexity in our symbolic / inferential capacities parallel the prior development of complexity in affective states. Finally, as described in the previous section, the capacity to generate narrative histories allows us to track unique individuals and to prioritize their well-being over more general or short-term situations. The full table of steps is provided in Figure 5. In each case, I specify the kind of property or object that is targeted, 2, the representational sophistication required to target this property or object, 3, the kind of affective state this object is tracked by, and 4, the descriptive states of mind that emerge as byproducts, such as regular perception that doesn't directly trigger a regulated response. This précis is too compressed to fully make sense of all these levels, but hopefully it can give readers a sense of how the major functions of the mind might be incorporated in this architecture. The book ends with an appendix on emotion dimensions, which concerns the key ways in which we distinguish emotions from each other. 7 dimensions are outlined: valence, power, temporal orientation, probability, social connectedness, temporal duration, and generality. The reader may note that all of these concepts have been mentioned at one point or another in the above précis. The combination of these dimensions allows us to differentiate extremely finely between emotion types and even to map emotional nuances in art and literature that lack linguistic labels in English. Overall, in my book, The Emotional Mind, I try to show how the incredibly complex range of activities going on in our emotional lives all fit together. The picture I provide is of one elaboration building on another. This, I think, helps us to see that there is some order in the chaos of our emotional lives. Article 2, Valent Representation, Problems and Prospects, by Anthony Hatzimoisis. The Emotional Mind, Cochrane 2018, is a book that moves against the current of contemporary philosophy of emotion. Methodologically, it is now commonplace to focus on the often turbulent surface of an emotional phenomenon, to then distinguish between its several dimensions, and subsequently to identify its characteristic marks, so as to eventually bring some theoretical order, which will facilitate the discovery of the emotion's conceptual core. That method fits well with the prevalent approach to mind as a varied terrain, divided into several districts, one of which happens to be occupied by certain states grouped under the heading of emotion. It seems to me that Tom Cochrane begs to differ on both counts. On the one hand, his method is not analytic, but synthetic. Instead of taking as given fully formed emotional phenomenon, he begins from the most basic elements of mental life, gradually building his way from the ground upwards. On the other hand, he treats emotion not as an add-on item of the mental landscape, not even as a discrete section of the psychological field, but as a central feature of our interaction with reality. In that sense, the title of the book is so literal that it might sound misleading. One may have to reach the end of the book in order to realize that the title does not imply that next to, for instance, a cognitive, volitional, or conscious mind, there is also an emotional mind. Instead, if the author is right, the human mind as such is, in a certain sense, emotional. Both the method and the substance of those claims deserve extended discussion. Here, I would like to concentrate on a core claim of the book, that emotions are valent representations of situated concerns. 10. Although it is put forward merely as a slogan, it appears to me that the phrase captures accurately the importance the author places upon the idea that emotion should be viewed as an elaborate exemplification of a foundational item of our mental life. Foundational, I would say, both diachronically, it seems to be more primitive than other types of mental content. Hence, it might reasonably be assumed to have arisen at an earlier stage of our evolutionary history, and synchronically, as it might constitute the ground level upon which more elaborate forms of representation are constructed. Valent representation is briefly defined as a type of mental content whose function is to detect the presence or absence of certain conditions. What makes that type of content valent is that, without needing the mediation of any other representational state, response is triggered that is disposed to either increase or decrease the presence of the condition being represented, page 1 to 2. The lack of a mediating state between the descriptive content and the directive content is crucial, as it holds the promise that the notion of valent representation can also apply to mental states that are wrapped up with automatic bodily responses, such as emotions, page 34. Although the end point of the discussion is to make sense of emotional phenomena, the reader might feel puzzled by the intricate details of the debates introduced, reconstructed, and resolved in Chapter 1, which, if I am not mistaken, is a text that includes no reference to the standard literature in philosophy of emotion. As Cochrane's argumentation unfolds, the discussion becomes more ambitious, aiming at nothing short of establishing a fundamental type of representational content, page 9, that pervades in various forms our mental economy. Why is the author taking up such a tall philosophical order? Because, I assume, he rightly wants to come clean on an issue that many other theorists of emotion find more convenient to leave unresolved. If emotion is neither an arbitrary compilation of fixed types of descriptive, conceptual, conative, prescriptive, etc., content, nor is it a state that can be easily reduced to other types of pre-existing perceptual, cognitive, behavioral, etc., states, then what sort of thing is it really? Cochrane rightly notes that, in emotions, three of the major strands of mind, representation, agency, and value, are tightly intertwined, page 9. Hence, if emotion is to count as genuinely important and distinct, it must be a state in which those three dimensions are seamlessly integrated. And that state is precisely what valent representation is supposed to be. There's an explanatory problem here. To wit, that valent representation sounds like a perfect fit. Indeed, a fit too good to be true. We were looking for something that somehow finally combined certain characteristics. And presto, here is a state with a new name which has all the desired characteristics as part of its definition. To avoid that problem, to prove that valent representation is something more than a convenient philosophical fiction, it is important to show that belief in its existence is independently motivated, i.e., that we have reasons to assert that this type of representation does real work, independently of its usefulness as a model for emotions, and the proper way to achieve that goal is the hard way, for which Cochrane opts in Chapter 1 of his book. His approach draws on Fred Dretske's causal theory of content, Ruth Garrett Millikan's consumerist theory of mental content, and Frank Ramsey's success semantics. A common claim in those different theories is that to understand representation, we need to look at what it does, or rather, at what its presence may help its possessor achieve, vis a vis the conditions in which it lives and the problems it encounters. Having a representation is primarily a matter of responding in a sensitive way to objects. Interaction entails that the creature has in some vital respect become attuned to the presence of that object. Page 15. That claim, in its turn, raises the issue of what exactly counts as an interaction. The standard way of tying possession of mental content with the performance of an act is the Humean theory of motivation, according to which, when a state with one direction of fit, call it reason or belief, gets intimate with a state with the opposite direction of fit, call it passion or desire, an action becomes their offspring. Let us think of the content enjoyed by the former kind of states as descriptive, and the content possessed by the latter kind of states as directive. Let us further assume that descriptive content is amenable to a naturalistic account that invokes some sort of causal impact between the agent and their environment. It is not equally easy to assume that the same applies to directive content. The problem here is twofold. On the one hand, it is not clear how the relevant state of desire can get started, and on the other, it is not obvious how that state may end. How can something not yet existent, such as a future aim or goal, cause the impact an agent, thus leading to the arising of the agent's specific desire? And how does, once you get started acting on that desire, the agent manage to stop? It appears, therefore, that the standard way of thinking about interaction with the environment in terms of two separate and disjoint types of representation faces some challenges. Moreover, even if those challenges were met, we would not have ipso facto resolved the problem of accounting specifically for emotion as a type of state in which external world awareness is wrapped up with automatic bodily responses. To make sense of emotions, what we need, as Cochrane puts it, are cases where the directive function is more immediately bound up with the acquaintance with an object or state of affairs. 2018, page 18. Cochrane finds a model of such cases in a specific mode of interaction that is involved in a type of representation that was introduced in the literature by Ruth Garrett Millikan, 1995, under the title of Push-Me-Pull-You Representation, PPR in short. PPR is a unitary state that faces two different directions, serving both a descriptive and a directive function. It thus is both truth conditions and satisfaction conditions. Millikan finds plenty of examples of PPRs in the natural world. An animal's called conspecifics connects directly with action, and as she continues to explain, its function is to mediate the production of a certain kind of behavior such that it varies as a direct function of a certain variation in the environment. Page 190. Appealing to considerations of simplicity, Millikan further claims that PPRs are more primitive than either purely descriptive or purely directive representations. The ability to store away information for which one has no immediate use, pure description, and to represent goals one does not yet know how to act on, pure direction, is surely more advanced than the ability to use simple kinds of push-me-pull-you representations, page 192. Cochrane clarifies his way of appropriating Millikan's approach with the following example. Suppose that whenever there is food lying in front of me, I grab that food. The descriptive representation of food in front of me could be wired up to directly stimulate my grabbing action. The behavioral output is reflex-like. Meanwhile, if that behavior serves to physically manipulate the object or environmental condition, it can help to fix reference. That is, the representational state is about whatever object or environmental condition the grabbing response is disposed to manipulate. Cochrane, 2018, page 20. He then moves on to elaborate, qualify, and extend in useful ways the PPR-based model, bringing into discussion novel insights about how the logic of negative and positive feedback circuits may illuminate the structure of both avoidant and attractant loops. The theoretical construction he erects in the rest of the first chapter and, subsequently, in the whole of the book is, to my mind, quite impressive. What I am not certain about is whether the appeal to PPRs can sustain such construction. I shall present certain considerations that tell against the explanatory power of the notion of push-me-pull-you representations. If those considerations are valid, PPRs are not a plausible ground for building a picture of the human mind. Given that Cochrane's view of emotions as valent representations is tied with the notion of PPRs, the problematic status of that notion, and the shortcomings of its explanatory power appear to undermine the author's project. Discussions of PPRs in the philosophical literature tend to focus exclusively on the compatibility of that type of representation with some form or other of a naturalized theory of mental content. C.F. Artigat, 2014. Although Cochrane's account is set in the tradition of philosophical naturalism, I propose that we consider whether his appeal to PPRs is justifiable, irrespective of our commitment to naturalized theories of mind. What we are interested in is whether PPRs may form a plausible model for valent representations, which purport to illuminate the structure of emotional experience. Recall that a PPR is a non-conjunctive representation with both descriptive and directive content. Its main function is to adapt behavior of an organism to environmental changes without intermediate inference. The notion of PPR is originally introduced by Millikan in 1999, as exemplified primarily in primitive representational systems. However, Cochrane's 2018 elaboration on the PPR notion is perfectly in tune with Millikan's agenda, since in her seminal paper she was quick to extend the application of that notion to value-laden forms of behavior and various patterns of human communication. What matters first for present purposes is to check whether there are actual cases satisfying conditions for some representation bearing both descriptive and directive content, and secondly, to consider whether such cases may include phenomena which relate closely to valent representations as the grounding element of emotional states. In addressing the former task, I shall rely heavily on my non-expert knowledge of the biological literature, which seems to suggest the following picture. PPRs can be attributed to plants, such as a wild lima bean, which exhibits a capacity to defend itself against herbivoral assault, thanks to its leaves releasing an airborne volatile that, when received by the selfsame plant's leaves or neighbor's leaves, initiates the release of sucrose on the leaf surface. That process in its turn attracts ants, which defend the leaves from intruding herbivores, Heil and Bueno 2007. The plant volatile maps onto the presence of the attacking herbivore, as well as onto the initiation of a response conducive to survival. The content of the volatile appears to be simultaneously. There's an herbivore slash initiate defenses, Bauer 2020. Given the extreme simplicity of the system, the volatile of the wild lima bean most plausibly counts as a non-inferential, non-mediated, non-conjunctive, and thus a push-me-pull-you representation. That phenomenon appears to fit perfectly the structure of valent representation, whose main function is to either increase or decrease the presence of the pertinent condition being represented. PPRs appear also in operation in the case of the telenid clam, a small burrowing bivalve whose foraging efficiency is at shallow depths in the sand, thus exposing themselves to predation, particularly from shore crabs. As soon as the clam detects the effluent from crabs feeding on their conspecifics, it burrows down to deeper depths. Yet once the effluent diminishes, the clam returns to shallow depths in the sand, Griffiths and Richardson 2006, Bauer 2020. In the present case, the effluent maps both onto the presence of actively foraging shore crabs and, simultaneously, onto the response of moving towards varied sand depth. Predators around slash move deeper is the simultaneously descriptive slash directive content of a biological organism that is too primitive to engage in inferential representational processing. Hence, we are also here encountering a case of PPR, as well as a fine fit for unitary, non-conjunctive valent representation. Let me finally refer to a case that may corroborate Cochrane's detailed and imaginative discussion of bacteria, though not those blessed with magnetosomes, but with a cylindrical spike-tipped inner tube inserted directly into the cytoplasm of a target cell. When the spike breaks off, it delivers toxins into the target cell. Leroux et al. 2015. The bacterium can detect cell envelope damage incurred by an attack, and it retaliates with its own attack directed in the direction of the detected assault. In the context of such a mutual attack, the retaliating cell is destroyed, but its destruction results in lysis, thereby spreading its danger signal into its surroundings, which results in an increased defensive response by the rest of the bacterial community. The signal seems to play both a descriptive and a directive role, simultaneously indicating cell envelope damage and initiating a targeted response, Bauer 2020. Another obvious case of a primitive system's exemplification of a unitary, non-mediated, non-inferential case of a representation that both tracks a vital change in the environment and triggers a fitting response. Plants, clams, and bacteria seem to furnish us with empirical evidence in support of the presence of push-me-pull-you representations and, if I understand them correctly, valent representations. However, our topic is not the on its own admirable domain of primitive biological systems, but of emotional phenomena of humans and other animals. How does the PPR hypothesis fare as soon as we move beyond the most elementary of living organisms? The answer, if my reading of the relevant literature is correct, is not very well. Indeed, except for a very limited subsection of animal signals, PPRs are simply not doing any of the explanatory work suggested by Millikan or by philosophers inspired by her original hypothesis. In fact, the standard example supplied by supporters of the PPR hypothesis, i.e., the bee's waggle dance, some bird songs, and vervet monkey's predator calls, are anything but unitary, non-conjunctive, double-facing instances of unitary representation. That is not surprising, given Millikan's insistence of approaching the nature of content via cases of signaling. That approach might make sense given specific agenda of Millikan's own version of teleosemantics. It might limit, though, the prospect of our research into the nature of mental content, a point also brought up by Cochrane's discussion. In any case, it appears that the case for PPRs in anything but the most primitive of organisms is hard to sustain. Related research on avians, fish, reptiles, and mammals reveal complexity in how descriptive and directive content are intertwined, enabling paper wasps, Tibbetts 2008, rattlesnakes, Owings 2002, canyon wrens, Benedict et al. 2012, lakeside lazy frogs, Schill 2012, and of course, prairie dogs, Slobodchikov 2002, to regularly and spontaneously engage in veracity testing, satisfaction testing, and directive denial with descriptive retention, Bauer 2020, none of which would be even conceivable if descriptive and directive content were not primarily given as clearly distinct. That an appeal to PPRs does not constitute a credible hypothesis as soon as we move into the complex world of animal life is not surprising. Given that members of most animal species are organisms with multimodal perceptual systems capable of registering information that needs to be processed across a variety of dimensions, assessing for consistency, accuracy, and some minimal degree of integration crucial to survival, Roe 1999, Stein and Meredith 1993. It is thus perhaps no accident that the standard way of introducing cases of PPRs as supposedly applying to human beings works in a single modality, and indeed, with regard to a single quality, C.F. Cochrane's lucid example, with which he opens his discussion of valent representations of a creature's registering the presence of slash withdrawing from a source of heat, Cochrane, 2018, page 14 to 15. In her seminal paper on the idea of a non-conjunctive, double-facing representation, Millikan is not shy of declaring the wide applicability of her hypothesis. Human thought and language in its various forms, intentions, norms, commands, performatives, even thick ethical concepts, all count as plausible cases of push-me-pull-you representations. Cochrane is not only more cautious in setting limits in the application of valent representation, but he is also meticulous in spelling out the mechanisms through which mental content is enriched as we move from valent representation to various forms of affectivity, of bodily feelings, and of emotions. I wonder, though, what might have been the impetus for building up such a refreshingly ambitious philosophical project on the basis of an idea about a type of representation, which, if my take on the relevant scientific literature is not too amiss, is not that significant presence in the animal kingdom, not to speak about the world of beings endowed with the capacity of conceptual thought, volition, and multimodal imagination. One answer might be that, contrary to what I have so far assumed, Cochrane's notion of valent representation, despite his own way of introducing the discussion of that notion, and his statement that he draws inspiration from Millikan's model of push-me-pull-you representations, page 49, is not, after all, related to push-me-pull-you representations. And thus, any problems that, in my view, pertain to the latter may hopefully leave the former totally unaffected. Let me conclude by stressing the significance of Cochrane's introduction of a valent representation for the current debate over the nature of emotion. Most analytic philosophers nowadays tend to argue for the identification of emotion with some other item of our mental life, be it judgment, perception, construal, feeling, or a combination thereof, through the hypothesis of valent representation. The emotional mind ventures to identify emotion with something that, if it exists, is both functionally substantial and irreducible to other types of mental phenomena, thus securing an important place for emotion as a truly distinct and fundamental feature of human life.
Article 3. Valent Representations, Bodily Feelings, and Social Norms, by Rebecca Hufendieck and Christine Sievers. Section 1. Valent Representations and Embodied Action. Oriented Representations. In the Emotional Mind, Tom Cochrane, 2018, provides a novel approach to explaining emotions by characterizing them as a particular form of valent representation. Valent representations, according to Cochrane, are a basic kind of mental capacity in which representational content relies on feedback from interaction with one's surrounding environment. Valent representation combines representation, valence, and action within a single system. Such systems may be perceived as systems of negative feedback control, known from cybernetics, whose function is to detect the presence or absence of specified conditions and to trigger a direct response with the aim of either enhancing or diminishing the presence of the condition being represented. Paradigmatic examples of valent representations include painful sensations that directly trigger symptoms of withdrawal from food or cravings for food that motivate the individual to eat until the cravings have been satisfied. Valent representations thus seek to eliminate the conditions that trigger them. While one might initially conceive valent representations as simple reflex-like responses, the notion of valent representation also aims to cover more subtle and cognitively demanding representations. The components of valent representations may gradually become increasingly elaborate through the inclusion of ever more sophisticated forms of control. The main point regarding the mind structure that Cochrane wishes to emphasize is its organization for the sake of ever more sophisticated and effective self-regulation, page 187. Within this structure, emotions form a subcategory of valent representations insofar as emotions are intentional, evaluative, and dispose us to respond. In this sense, emotions as valent representations resemble Millikan's push-me-pull-you representations in that they are action-oriented and truth-tracking. In contrast to Millikan's proposal, however, the content of a valent representation is not determined by its evolutionary survival value, e.g., danger run away. Rather, its content fulfills a homeostatic function for the organism, maintaining an internal balance. In pulling an individual toward or deterring them from an object in the environment, valent representation regulates the basic elements necessary for survival, for example, food, warmth, and air. Cochrane also draws inspiration from Ramsey's success semantics, that is, the idea that actions depend on the accuracy of the representations that guide them. However, the valent structure of Cochrane's representations provides a more detailed explanation of how actions become bound up with a particular representation, namely, by means of their homeostatic function. Cochrane's proposal is thus related to the approaches from both teleosemantics and success semantics, but it also adopts its own approach in deriving its main mechanisms from cybernetics. Emotions form a subcategory of valent representation that is distinguished from other valent representations by virtue of the kinds of objects they represent. Emotions not only represent a particular intentional object, such as a dog, but represent it in combination with a so-called formal object, such as loss, in sadness, or threat, in fear. Those formal objects of emotions may be characterized as relations between oneself and the emotion elicitor that have a bearing on one's well-being, or as contextually situated concerns. When an individual is guided toward a particular object in an emotional manner, the intentional object in question, e.g. a dog, is predicated as a threat, in fear, or as a loss, in sadness. Such emotional representations may vary in intensity, whereby this intensity is correlated with disposed regulation mechanisms that prepare the individual, e.g., for flight or to cope. The key to emotional representation is the cognitive capacity for contextually oriented representation. All emotions represent the status of concerns relative to a wider context, temporal, modal, and social. This ability to represent situated concerns is what distinguishes emotions from simpler sensations, such as pain or hunger, which do not necessarily engage these abilities. This sensitivity to context does not involve the demanding cognitive abilities that infants and animals lack. Rather, it requires that the creature is capable of some form of recreative thinking, that is, cognition that uses expectations, memories, or counterfactual imaginings. In fear, for instance, the avoidant concern is predicated as imminent or its presence as increasing. Cochrane's model offers an appealingly unified account of valent representations, ranging from simple responses to complex representations within a mechanistic framework. This offers us some guidance as to how we might conceive of emotions as simple action-guiding responses in infants and animals, as well as context-sensitive evaluative states. While Cochrane argues for the centrality of bodily feelings, he does not consider his approach to be embodied in the narrower sense. Rather, he proposes that emotional intentionality is twofold. While emotions at their core represent situated concerns, such as threat or loss, they are typically, but not invariably, accompanied by an additional layer of representational content that represents bodily feelings and fulfills a regulative function in monitoring bodily capacities. Adopting an embodied perspective, one might object that emotional feelings are the intense and rich experiences that they are because they are constituted by a range of bodily processes. To this objection, Cochrane responds that upon closer examination, the non-bodily phenomenology of emotions is rich and intense in itself, and that once we recognize this, we no longer need bodily feelings to add color to a cold appraisal, 2018, page 92. This is slightly confusing, however, Given that the core feelings that Cochrane then describes as non-bodily emotional feelings are those where everything seems to slow down or speed up, where the threat was looming menacingly, the world was spinning. 2018, page 92. Even on a phenomenological level, some of these feelings may arguably be traced directly to changes in heart rate or muscle tension. Furthermore, authors who embrace embodied accounts, including Damasio, 2000, Prinz, 2004, and Hufendieck, 2016, argue that bodily responses constitute not only feelings that may be traced on a conscious level to symptoms of bodily arousal, such as a pounding heart, but also plausibly enable one to conceive of an emotional experience in which everything slows down, as a feeling constituted by changes in blood pressure, hormone levels, etc., that we are unable to trace as such, but that still constitute the phenomenological core of emotions. Cochrane's main argument against this claim appears to be that bodily feelings themselves lack any information about the detected external situation or the situated concern. A core concern results from a sophisticated act of cognition that then triggers bodily responses. 2018, page 90. Embodied accounts have developed a response to this concern, however. Hufendieck, 2016, construes emotions as action-oriented representations of affordances, whereby the bodily responses in the history of a species and/or an organism have co-occurred with the relevant situated concerns so frequently that they carry information about bodily preparations, e.g., for flight or fight. Cochrane, 2018, suggests replacing Millikan's stance that representational content is determined by survival value with a homeostatic approach. A homeostatic approach regards valent representation as fulfilling a balance-maintaining function. This seems to be a compelling suggestion. From such a homeostatic approach, however, it arguably follows that emotions regulate bodily responses in the face of situated concerns. Furthermore, the bodily responses directly feed into the content of the action-oriented representation within a dynamic system. Threats are not threats to a disembodied cognizer. Rather, they are threats to embodied creatures who have a history of interacting with them, both as a species and as individuals. It is hard to see why somebody would want to introduce valent representation as a representation type whose function it is to regulate bodily responses, only then to draw an artificial distinction between the core representation of a situated concern and the representation of bodily responses, but this seems to be what Cochrane is suggesting. These observations raise several questions for the emotion theorist. It is not controversial to state that emotions may be triggered by social scenarios that are relevant to the individual, and that certain social scenarios may be of more urgent concern than basic needs, such as hunger, and may thus override them. To what degree, however, are emotions felt, valued, regulated, and enacted in different ways in different social contexts and cultures? Observable differences emerge, for example, in U.S. American expressions of anger and Tibetan expressions of lung lang, but also in how people of different genders or who occupy different levels within workplace hierarchies tend to express anger. One means of theoretically accounting for these observations is to conceive of such different expressions of anger as habitual and skillful responses that largely result from different processes of habituation in different social contexts. Hufendieck, 2020. Such accounts may explain how social norms, and more generally social influences, may determine what potential or kind of emotional response we display and in which situations, as well as how our bodily responses are attuned to that which is considered socially adequate in such contexts. Another question to be raised concerns animal emotions and the extent to which stereotypes concerning basic, almost hardwired emotional responses, such as fear responses, may be queried in light of a potential socio-normative relatedness between human and non-human emotional displays. Animal emotional responses appear to be far more flexible in terms of social influences, and therefore may require more elaboration regarding explanations of the involved proximate and ultimate mechanisms. Within Cochrane's framework of valent representations, social norms could potentially play a role with respect to the representation's content and the concrete emotional responses. That is, it may not be simply via memory and other contextual factors that social factors come to matter. However, Cochrane may also be suggesting that we become ontogenetically attuned to social norms in a way that shapes our bodily response patterns and the representational content. The content of guilt or shame responses, for instance, appears to presuppose a learned understanding of social norms. Situations such as described above, in which we experience fear but behave in a manner that is seemingly brave. For example, helping others instead of running away may be precisely the kind of example that highlights this additional important role of social norms. This scenario may be interpreted as one in which the individual feels fear and exhibits the emotion of fear, but the actual fear response, as part of the valent representation, is determined by social norms of cooperation. That is, the response is not related to bravery on a representational level, but rather the content of the valent representation is harnessed for social purposes through the influence of social norms. In light of current empirical research on emotions and social norms, it would be interesting and significant to determine whether and how such an interpretation might be discerned in Cochrane's account. Where Cochrane does mention the influence that social norms exert on emotions, he is primarily concerned with the regulation of our emotional display. For instance, we ought to feel sad at the funeral of a family member, and we ought to be happy and smile at a friend's wedding, and so on. However, such claims merely amount to our potential judgment of the emotion as inadequate relative to social norms or as fallen short of one's own ideals. Cochrane, 2018, page 153. In the case of fear, according to Cochrane, we may experience fear when we ought to be brave. Page 153. Social norms, following Cochrane, influence whether our exhibition of the emotion and our response thereto align with how we feel. However, social norms appear to influence considerably more than bodily self-regulation. In principle, therefore, Cochrane's theory provides the requisite tools for an approach that closely links bodily self-regulation and the formative power of social norms within a broader approach to emotions. However, he misses the opportunity to unpack the details. While it appears that Cochrane's account may be largely compatible with an account that construes emotions as skillful and socially situated responses, it is difficult to be certain what that would entail precisely.
Article 4. Cochrane's Nativism. By Rami Majid. Section 1. The Nativist Dilemma. The overall aim of this commentary is to draw out a feature Cochrane's, 2018, view not made explicit in his book, and to invite him to say a bit more about it. This topic is nativism about emotion. The view that our emotions are systems/mechanisms/programs hardwired into our brains by evolution and purposefully built to generate certain expressive, physiological, and behavioral responses. According to Cochrane's control theory of effect, affective phenomena, e.g., feelings, emotions, sentiments, etc., are to be understood in terms of what he calls valent representations. Very roughly, self-regulating mechanisms which are triggered automatically in response to certain stimuli and aim to either increase or decrease the presence of such stimuli. My focus will be on what the control theory tells us about emotion. What is striking is that while the account offers with respect to emotion is no doubt novel, it shares certain similarities with other nativist conceptions of emotion. First, Cochrane thinks the self-regulatory mechanisms responsible for affective phenomena are somewhat modular in nature. Page 83. Modular accounts presuppose a nativist conception of emotion, where modules are typically thought of as systems/mechanisms/programs hardwired to perform certain tasks. Griffiths, 1997. The self-regulatory mechanisms responsible for our emotions seem to fit this profile. Second, he thinks of such mechanisms as being governed by innate concerns, that is, the sorts of stimuli that can trigger our emotional responses are innately specified in aid of meeting certain regulatory ends. This is not to deny that emotions manifest a degree of flexibility. You fear not just dangerous objects in the environment of evolutionary adaptation, EA, like snakes and spiders, but things like not saving enough for your retirement, your children failing their exams, your partner getting into a car crash, etc., things which don't obviously aid self-regulation. But crucially, such flexibility is to be explained in terms of how our innate sensitivity to a concern can be tuned toward a new object, page 83. Third, like most nativists, he thinks that emotions form a natural kind. In particular, he claims to recognize the class of emotions as a natural kind, Contra Griffiths, 1997, page 66. Cochrane doesn't actually say what natural kinds are, but on Griffiths's account, natural kind categories are projectable categories that can enter into scientific generalizations. In other words, if a category is a natural kind, the correlations observed in some of its samples can be reliably extrapolated to other instances of that category. We can suppose that emotion categories like fear and grief are projectable in this sense because there are certain self-regulating mechanisms which have evolved specifically to regulate these emotions. Moreover, it might be that the broader category emotion also forms a projectable category because its instances all share a certain regulatory profile. Nativism about emotion now has a relatively long and potted history. Its influence is hard to overestimate, but also has well-known problems. One of the central philosophical problems can be cashed out in terms of a dilemma. Nativists about emotion can either claim that emotions, or a subcategory of them, form a natural kind at the cost of accommodating many of the affective phenomena we typically count as emotion, or they can accommodate a more diverse range of phenomena at the cost of arguing that emotions are natural kinds. To elaborate, in attempting to argue that there is a subset of emotion categories that form a natural kind, they limit the sorts of phenomena which can be classified as emotion. Typically, they eschew talk of more complex emotional phenomena, e.g. like jealousy, grief, love, and take these to be either handled by other accounts, e.g. social constructionism, or to be eliminated from our emotion ontologies completely. This, the complaint goes, gives us an impoverished view of emotion. The point works just as well if we replace the notion of natural kinds with modules or emotion-specific affect programs. Unlike most nativist accounts, Cochrane's view, as he presents it, dodges this dilemma. That is, he argues that emotions are natural kinds and does so all the while attempting to accommodate a more diverse range of phenomena than is typical of nativist accounts of emotion. The regulatory mechanisms account for not just basic emotions like anger and sadness, but more complex emotional phenomena, e.g. hatred and grief, as well. This, ceteris paribus, makes his account much more attractive than other nativist accounts of emotion. But an important question remains unanswered. Is Cochrane justified in presenting his view in this way, i.e., as one that evades a dilemma? On the face of it, there is enough material in Cochrane's arsenal to evade it. There are layers upon layers of regulatory mechanisms that might be capable of handling basic and complex emotional phenomena alike. However, I am skeptical that he can actually pull this off, mainly because his account is not adequately sensitive to the sorts of concerns that motivate the dilemma in the first place. There are quite a few different issues at play here, all which have come up in debates about emotional nativism. These issues are well known, so I shall only mention them briefly and focus mainly on how they arise with respect to the control theory. I don't think these issues, either by themselves or collectively, refute the control theory. However, I do think they are important and should be addressed if the view is to be taken seriously. Section 2. Natural kinds. As noted, Cochrane doesn't actually offer a positive account of what natural kinds are. However, we can note that in most, if not all the ways of conceiving of natural kinds, there is more to being a natural kind than simply having certain things in common. This point is nicely brought out by Griffiths. In What Emotions Really Are, The Problem of Psychological Categories, Griffiths, 1997, makes two claims. First, the vernacular category emotion doesn't form a natural kind because it picks out three very different kinds of things. Basic emotions, cognitively complex emotions, and social pretenses, all of which are brought about by very different kinds of causal mechanisms. Second, that being said, basic emotions do form natural kinds because they stem from certain evolved emotion-specific mechanisms. For example, there's a mechanism for fear, a mechanism for sadness, and so on. The important point for us is that in making the first claim, Griffiths, 2002, is at pains to point out that the question of whether emotions form a natural kind is a different question from whether the concept of emotion can be given a univocal analysis. He thinks the latter is possible, and only takes his project to show that things which fall under the vernacular category emotion don't form a natural kind for the purposes of scientific inquiry. For instance, he points out that we can think of emotion as a putative psychological category of motivational states that exhibit passivity, Griffiths, 1997, page 246. One worry I have is that Cochrane doesn't seem to recognize this distinction. This is best brought out by his discussion of long-term emotions, or what he calls sentiments. Note, the term sentiment and emotion are often used interchangeably, but this isn't quite what Cochrane has in mind. By sentiment, He means enduring attitudes that we bear towards specific individuals that coordinate a broad pattern of emotions that are sustained and developed over long periods of time. Cochrane, 2018, page 175. Thus understood, sentiments are complex, enduring affective phenomena that aren't emotions themselves but depend on them. For example, your grief for a loved one who has passed away can involve bouts of intense sadness, anger, panic, numbness, etc. I shall continue to lump sentiments under the broad banner of complex emotional phenomena. This raises an interesting question. What is the essence of a sentiment such as grief? Since a single sentiment may involve various kinds of feelings and cognitive appraisals, Goldie, 2012, argues that instead of searching for an essential feature, it is best to think of sentiments as emergent processes involving various stages, all tied together by a narrative arc. Cochrane remains unconvinced. I doubt Goldie's claim that there is no single element underlying grief. On the contrary, I think we can say that the process of grief is sustained by the underlying concern for the dead individual, Cochrane, 2018, page 174. Fair enough. It looks like we can give a univocal analysis of the concept of grief, but this is a far cry from arguing that grief is a natural kind. It is worth noting that Cochrane never explicitly claims that sentiments form a natural kind, only that emotions do. However, there are certainly parts of the book which suggest otherwise. For example, he claims that the emergent process of grief that Goldie described is actually the product of the kind of long-term adaptation I described earlier. Page 174. One of my worries is that I've not seen anything in the book to justify the claim that grief, or any other sentiment, is actually an adaptation. On the plus side, this gives us a clearer indication of why sentiments like grief might count as natural kinds on the control theory. Very roughly, there is an evolved system slash mechanism slash program that all instances of a sentiment have in common, which coordinate the complex set of emotional responses we associate with that sentiment. Still, I think it's worth pressing the question. That is, why think this? Even if we buy into the nativist claim that there are effect programs for certain basic emotions, like sadness, anger, and panic, it does not follow that there is a higher-level executive program that coordinates these emotions, one we can take to be a grief program. Most nativists don't make this extra claim, and it remains unclear why it is warranted here. Section 3. Complex Emotional Phenomena. This brings us to the second issue. Can we account for complex emotional phenomena using the sort of machinery we use to explain the simpler ones? According to Cochrane, 2018, page 12, each distinctive form of affective state, e.g., emotions, feelings, sentiments, correspond with a layer of regulated control. I don't deny that regulatory mechanisms might be at play when it comes to complex affective phenomena, such as our sentiments. However, it is less clear to me whether we can understand them purely in terms of such regulatory mechanisms, no matter how multi-layered they turn out to be. Since there is layer upon layer of regulatory control on this view, the precise nature of the dependence relations between sentiments and emotions isn't entirely clear. As I understand it, sentiments, such as grief, are to be understood in terms of certain emotional dispositions, or as Cochrane specifies, dispositions to regulate concerns, page 162. This is not to deny their difference. One difference between emotion and sentiment is that emotions are single-track dispositions, whereas sentiments involve multi-track dispositions. For example, while sadness involves certain expressive physiological and behavioral responses, grief can involve the characteristics of several different emotions. It can include those of sadness, but it can also include those of anger and panic. There are at least two worries with such a view. First, whether even basic emotions, such as sadness, can be identified with an evolved affect program or module is highly controversial. A major problem is that despite initial optimism, the latest neuroscience evidence suggests that there are no hardwired neurological profiles for basic emotions. For instance, while we used to think that there was a specific amygdala-centered circuitry for fear, the latest meta-analyses have failed to reveal any fear circuitry that remains constant across studies, Barrett, 2013. To be clear, the amygdala is implicated in fear, but it turns out that it is neither necessary nor sufficient for fear. This is part of the much bigger problem, often known as the problem of variability. The main issue is that the empirical data available doesn't support the existence of any biological markers, either in the body or the brain, associated with basic emotions, such as anger, sadness, fear, happiness, etc., Scarantino 2015. So, whether there are programs or modules for basic emotions, regulatory or otherwise, remains a point of contention. It would be good to know where Cochrane stands on this problem. The other problem is that even if we can show that there are modules for basic emotions, whether we can explain complex emotional phenomena in terms of such modules remains a matter of debate. That we can explain complex emotions in terms of blends of basic emotions is an old idea, but to my mind, not a very plausible one. A significant problem concerns appraisal criteria. Such criteria for complex emotions are too sophisticated to be obtained by merely adding together criteria for various basic emotions. Griffiths 2002. For example, as Jones 2008 points out, jealousy is triggered not merely by the smell of unfamiliar perfume on your lover or the recognition that they are once again late from work, but when these features are interpreted as signs of infidelity. So, complex emotions don't seem to be reducible to basic ones. A similar point can also be made with respect to sentiments. While sentiments might involve dispositions to manifest certain basic emotional responses, they can't be reduced to such emotions. Grief, for instance, is triggered not merely at the sight of certain stimuli, but when such stimuli are interpreted as signs of significant loss. Section 4. Emotional plasticity. The final problem is related, i.e., to what extent can the account accommodate the sorts of flexibility manifested in complex emotions and sentiments? Everyone seems to agree that emotions are plastic, that they can be shaped and reshaped by us, as well as our socio-cultural environments, Taplet 2018. Cochrane does discuss such plasticity to an extent under the title Behavioral Flexibility, which he tries to explain in terms of how our innate sensitivity to a concern can be tuned toward a new object, page 83. But it is doubtful that this fully captures all the ways our emotions are plastic. The first thing to note here is that Cochrane actually grants far less flexibility to emotions than do recent advocates of the basic emotion theory, BET. According to the old, perhaps caricatured, view, our emotions are input and output closed. That is, both the stimuli that trigger our emotions, as well as the behaviors that are generated as part of the emotional responses, are innately specified and fixed. Cochrane's account is an improvement insofar as he thinks of emotions as being input open. However, crucially, unlike advocates of the new basic emotion theory, e.g. Scarantino, 2015, he thinks of our emotions as still being output fixed. As we saw earlier, it remains unclear whether our emotions, even the basic ones, correspond to any fixed behavioral profiles. What's more, here we can see that our emotions manifest a lot more behavioral flexibility than Cochrane seems to allow. Even an emotion like fear can manifest a complex range of behaviors, arguably much too complex to be innately specified. The other point of note here is that advocates of the new BET don't think their account extends complex emotions like jealousy, let alone sentiments like grief and love. To my mind, this is sensible. Short-lived emotional responses, which are the sorts of things envisioned as the outcomes of innate modules, don't seem to be the right sort of things to account for the output side of complex emotional phenomena. Of course, Cochrane could push back. Sentiments just are dispositions to have various short-lived emotional responses. However, as we have seen, the issues raised in Section 3 speak against this. It is entirely possible that I have misunderstood Cochrane's position. Perhaps complex emotional phenomena are to be accommodated by various higher-level cognitive processes in conjunction with the sorts of regulatory mechanisms that ground our basic emotions. If so, it would be good to have a bit more clarity on this. So far as I can tell, Cochrane thinks it is self-regulatory mechanisms all the way down. I just don't see how this is possible without describing all, if not most, mental processing as forms of self-regulation. Section 5. Conclusion. To end, let me offer what I take to be the general lesson. Nativist positions are plausible to the extent that they offer certain concessions. In broad strokes, nativist theories only accommodate some phenomena we normally count as emotion. This often leaves philosophers unsatisfied, but it might be a price worth paying if their views are to be considered plausible. Cochrane's more ambitious strand of nativism appears to evade this pitfall by extending nativism beyond the realm of basic emotions to more complex emotional phenomena, including sentiments. But the main worry is that it does so at the expense of preserving what was plausible about such views in the first place.
This marks the end of the 2024, Volume 5, Issue 2, Winterer Podcast Edition, Part 1, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please go to 2024, Volume 5, Issue 2, Winterer Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, to continue listening to this issue.